Can you clip this on? I think there should be something to advance the slides, but I don't see it.
Do you want a clicker?
A clicker, that sounds good. Is it going to work?
Why, yes, it will.
So, just USB, plug it in, works like a keyboard.
Okay. It works. Fantastic. Okay, I'll get going. My name's Terry Jones, which I guess is obvious. I'm not entirely sure why I'm here, but Robert invited me to come along and give you guys a talk. My second slide is probably the more accurate title. Which is, how did I wind up trying to build something that looks like a database? I'll go into some of that story, and I've been a little bit reluctant to call this a database because in many ways it's not, and when you say that something is a database, there are certain expectations, and almost none of them are met by what we're doing. However, database is sort of the most familiar object in the mind of the venture capitalist, and when you try to describe what you're doing, it's helpful if you can give people a familiar object that they can begin to sort of frame their thoughts around. So reluctantly, after many years, I started to call this a database, and you guys can be the judge. Anyway, I really do know literally nothing about databases. One thing I would like to point out in the beginning is that these are still early days. We have been working on this for a number of years, but when you consider things like Postgres and MySQL and so on, and those kinds of projects, they've been around for, you know, roughly 20 years or something like that, and they're much more mature products. This is an experiment in many ways. It's an experiment that probably shouldn't be being done inside of a company. It should probably be in a university somewhere. But I don't really like universities, and so I'm doing it in a company. As I said, there's a lot that remains to be done. It's still vaporware in some sense, but it's also vaporware that's very close to being released. So I think probably in about 6 weeks' time we'll have a release, and it'll be an alpha, and lots of things will be wrong. It will be very slow, but most of what I'm going to show you today will actually be there and will be usable via the API. So just very quickly, Fluid Info is a company in London, founded 3 years ago. There's only two of us working on the project. We do the development in Barcelona, most of it in my apartment. And we have some friends and family funding, and I also took some money from Esther Dyson, who has put money into some quite well-known startups over the years and has been very supportive of what we're doing. I'd like to start by trying to give you the motivations for what I'm doing or what we're doing. You know, why did this project kick off? What are we trying to achieve at a high level, before going into the details of what the architecture looks like and so on? And just very quickly, I'm interested in how people work with information, how we as humans work with information in the real world. You know, the kinds of things we do, the mistakes we make, duplication of information, things that are inconsistent, how information evolves over time. I think very much in terms of evolutionary systems, selection pressure. And I'm also interested in things like user interface, and APIs, which are interfaces to information. And I'm interested in personalization because I'm a hacker, like I guess almost everybody here, and I like to customize the world for myself, my computational environment and so on. So I'll go into some of these details very quickly to try to get you a bit more lively. I know it's Friday afternoon and most of you are only partially here, including myself. First of all, let's think about concepts, because humans work with concepts a lot of the time, or we like to think that we do. And concepts have got some nice properties. They don't have owners. They don't have any formal structure. You don't need permission to add to a concept or to change a concept. For example, we all have the concept of Ottawa. And when I landed in Ottawa, there were certain things I didn't know about the city. I now think it's quite green, it's quite flat, and so on. I didn't have to go to the mayor of Ottawa and ask for permission to change, you know, that object or that concept of Ottawa. I just did it. No one had to anticipate that I was going to come along and want to have some, you know, control or some influence or add some content to the concept of Ottawa. And I'm sharing my ideas about Ottawa with you guys, but other people who are not in this room don't know what we're talking about necessarily. I could have a private opinion about Ottawa that I don't tell you about, that I just share with a couple of close friends and so on. Concepts are, you know, partially organized, sometimes fully organized, sometimes they have multiple different organizations. They don't have, you know, a predefined set of qualities. There's no special central piece of content, which is sort of like the data surrounded by metadata. And it's easy to reorganize and multiply organize them. So there's all sorts of nice properties about concepts that there's ways of working with information or working with concepts that are very fluid and they're very ad hoc. A lot of things are very unanticipated. That's what we do as humans. And when you compare the way we work with information in the real world with the way we work with information using a computer, you begin to see that things are incredibly awkward when we use computers. There's all sorts of things that we do in the real world that you just can't do with computational systems. And that kind of annoys me. And, you know, I'm sort of scratching my own itch by building the stuff that I'm going to show you today. So if you want to engineer this kind of flexibility, one of the things that becomes clear quite quickly is that we have to rethink control. A lot of these points are to do with control of information. You know, what's the structure? Do you have to ask for permission to change it? And so on. The second thing I want to talk about quickly in terms of motivation is user interfaces and APIs. These are kind of the same thing, if you think about it. A user interface gives humans access to information, and an API gives programs access to information. So, you know, in particular, the API of a database allows a program to go in and get at information and query it, maybe add to it, and so on. Anyway, the things that I think about when I use a user interface, which is basically every single day, is I think, you know, that's my information. When I'm on a browser and I put a comment onto a website or a rating onto something, that's information that I created. And I wonder, you know, where did it go? When I put a 6, let's say, into a rating, I think to myself, where is that 6? Why can't I get it back? Why can't I search on it? Why can't I combine it with other information? Why can't I delete it or protect it or share it? All sorts of things like that. You know, is there an API? Can I get to that? You know, when I type something into Twitter, I'm thinking, can I get to that piece of information through an API? And all sorts of things like that. The thing about user interfaces and APIs is that we like to think of them in very friendly terms. You know, we think, oh, they're there to help us, and they make life easier, and so on. And that's all true, but on the other hand, they also control what you can do. So if you're sensitive to these kinds of things, and I don't want to appear to be a sensitive New Age guy, but if you think about this stuff, then you end up feeling very restricted all of the time because you're under the control of what a bunch of programmers or user interface designers anticipated that you might want to do with information. And that's almost always too restrictive. You almost always run into situations where you want to do things that no one anticipated. And I can give you thousands of examples just off the top of my head. Or hundreds, anyway. And you can probably think of your own ones as well. And Twitter is a beautiful example because there's lots and lots of things that people want to do to Twitter, and they can't really do them. There is an API, but it's very restrictive. There's lots of things you might want to do to a database, and the API may not let you. You may not be given that opportunity to work with information the way you want to work with it. The next one I want to go through is about personalization. As I said, I love hacking and writing my own little tools. I've got something like 1,000 things sitting in my bin directory in my Unix machine. All little hacks that I wrote over the decades. I was going to say years, but it's really actually decades to make my life simpler, to do stuff that I want to do. And I think personalization is becoming much more important on the web, but personalization hasn't reached the level really of individuals yet. We're getting there, but we're still at the level where you go to Amazon and they say, well, people like you, you know, bought a book, this book, or they bought some other similar book. What I want to know is, did you buy that book? Have you looked at that book? And did you look at that book? Personalization, I want that to be in my hands. I don't care so much about Amazon saying, well, we've got some friends who are sort of similar. I want to know about someone who I respect, whose movie opinion I like. I want to know if they saw the movie and what they thought of it. So I want personalization really at the level of individuals. And then the final thing I want to say is that if you think about it, the world the way I think about it, you can see that most of our computational experience, we're in read-only mode. Most of the time when you use a computer to work with objects, whether they're files or web pages or so on, you can't write them. You can read information, but you can't just contribute information as you might like. And even when you can contribute information that you want to add to an object, you can only do it in the ways that have been anticipated. So you can go to Twitter and you can add a new tweet, for example, but you can't put a like. Well, you can put a like. You can star something and say this is a favorite or not a favorite, but you can't put a comment onto a tweet, or you can't add a ratio, let's say, of the number of people who are following to the number of people who are followed and put it on the user. So most of your computational experience is read-only. And if you want to write, you've got to put your information somewhere else, and that's too much work. And even if you do it, the extra information is not very useful because you can't combine it with other people's information. And it's my opinion, and I'm convinced about this enough that I sold my own apartment to follow these ideas, that we are going to make a transition from a world that's mainly read-only to a world in which we can always write. And I think Delicious changed the world in a very good way in that respect, because they got people used to the idea that when they bumped into a web page, they could tag it and they could contribute information. And then they could start to do things like look at what other people had done, organize things a little bit, and so on. I think there is going to be a transition towards a more writable computational world. And I think it should happen at an architectural level, not at the level of applications. And one more quick point is that search is not very interactive. What can you do when you do a search? You can ask for more results. You can change your query a little bit, but you can't change the results. You just get to look at them. You're a passive consumer in some sense. Why can't you change the results? Google has recently made some small steps. I shouldn't say that. Has made some steps in these directions. They've introduced something called the Search Wiki, where you can vote the results up and down a little bit. So we're heading a little bit towards a more writable world, but I really think it has to change at an architectural level, and that's what we're trying to do. So I started asking myself some questions, having spent many, many years working with computers and thinking about what I was doing and watching the way other people worked. And the first question is, why don't our architectures let us work with information in a more flexible way? And I think the answer is that we're living in the shadows of architectural decisions that were made decades ago, and we're restricted at an architectural level from just arbitrarily writing. Then the next question, of course, is what would it take to build something that would allow us to write in general and to work more flexibly with information? How can we address all of these problems at the same time? All those things that I just listed about personalization, about writability, all the flexibility that we have with concepts. Can you do something? Is there some trick, some martial arts trick where you don't use too much energy and you use the force of the opponent to get what you want, is there a way that we could build all this stuff at the same time? I think the answer might be yes, and that's what we're trying to figure out. Here's a quote that to me is very important. It sort of captures the most important element of what we're doing. Alan Kay, I guess many of you will be familiar with. If not, go to Wikipedia and have a look. The first paragraph is nice. It's basically saying point of view is very important, and if you're trying to do mathematics with Roman numbers, it's very difficult. The second paragraph is the one that I really like. He's saying the main thing that we do as computer scientists is try to think of better representations. And you don't have to get smarter. If you have a better representation, you don't have to be smarter, because the representation itself will help you to solve problems. And so I'm getting to the point, I promise you. In FluidDB, which I'm about to describe, we have a different representation of information. And this quote is very resonant for me, because if you just change the way you represent information, some of these things that look like very big problems, I think they basically disappear. And I'll show you what I mean by that. Here's two addition problems. If you know what the sum is on the left, you're probably a geek. On the other hand, if you represent this, I mean, this is quite a difficult problem. If you ask a child to add up those numbers, they probably won't be able to do it. They'll make mistakes. On the other hand, if you use a binary representation, it's not even worth writing the problem down. The problem basically vanishes. It takes you much more time to write the problem down than it does to figure out the answer, because there is no problem in that representation. Here's another example, going back to Roman numerals. This is an addition problem. What's the total? Well, you know, that's pretty hard. That's even harder than the last problem I showed you. It turns out the answer is D, which is kind of non-intuitive. And it turns out that Roman numerals are a very bad representation for doing mathematics. They're not even additive. You can see these circles I've put up here. You can't even read left to right and figure out what the number is, because sometimes you've got to subtract. You can't just add up along the way. But, of course, this problem is very simple if you change the representation. Here's another one very quickly. The eight queens problem. How many people know the eight queens problem? Very few of you. Okay, well, you have to put eight queens on a chessboard so that they can't attack each other mutually. The exact details of the problem aren't that important. What's important is that if you choose to if you try and solve this problem inside of a computer, you can represent it using 64 bits, each one of which is a 1 or a 0, to indicate whether or not there's a queen. If you take that representation, you've just made yourself a search space of size 2 to the 64. A very, very big search space, and you need a smart algorithm to wander around in that search space looking at candidate solutions and figuring out whether or not they're correct or not. On the other hand, if you think a little bit more, you can have a representation which is just a permutation. You can say, well, the queen in the first row, if it's in column 4, nothing else can be in column 4, so we'll use a 4 for that queen, and in the next row, we'll use a 7, let's say, and you come up with a permutation, and the state space is only 40,000 big. And if the state space is only 40,000 big, you can use exhaustive search. So the problem didn't change, but the representation changed. And we went from needing a very smart algorithm to being able to use the stupidest algorithm on the planet and solve the problem in the blink of an eye. So these are all examples of why representation is very important in computer science and in problem solving. So what do we do in FluidDB? Here we're sort of getting to the meat of the talk. I'm done with motivating you. I can see you're all highly excited. What's the representation that we're using in FluidDB? Basically, it's a database full of objects, and I use that word in the most sort of abstract sense. I don't mean objects in a programming sense. I just mean they're things. It's like a web of things, if you like. And the objects are composed of attributes and values. So here we've got an orange blob on the left, which is representing an object, and it has five attributes on it with values. And I've chosen a set of attributes to represent, to give you an example of strings and integers and booleans and so on. This object has got a something that looks like a URL on it. It's got a rating, someone's opinion. It's even got the special attribute called about, which is saying, well, this is about the following URL. These are the kinds of objects that FluidDB deals in. And in a sense, there's nothing else in FluidDB. It's full of objects that look like this.
When you say values, do you mean values as, you know, raw strings or data types?
Strings or data types, dates, blobs, booleans. You can even say the value may not be present on some objects. You know.
So there's not even data type enforcement.
There is data type enforcement. Well, I'll get to that when I talk about the query language. Yeah. It's structured in the sense that the values do have types. The most important thing to understand about these objects, and this is the piece of sort of mental jujitsu, if you like, is that the objects don't have owners. And that's a quite a big difference from normal computational systems and the way that programmers like to build things. When we as programmers like to build systems, we're used to being in control. And we're used to things having objects, like having owners. You know, files have got owners, web pages have got owners in some sense. And you can't touch or change an object unless you own it. In FluidDB, it's completely different. There is no owner on the objects. And what that means is that when you find an object one way or another, you always can add things to it. So that's why we say, in some sense, it's like a database with the heart of a wiki. Because every single application or user always has the ability to add new information to objects. And that's an easy thing to say, but it's a hard thing to get your head around it. I spent about a year thinking about that, and I'm still discovering ways in which that's nice and allows you to do to solve problems that are difficult when you do have objects with owners. So what else can we say about that? There's no distinction between metadata and data, which is another very awkward thing about the computational systems that we usually build, is that, you know, programmers or someone makes a decision, they say, here's the content or here's the data, and around that data we'll put some metadata. But the real world doesn't really work that way. I like to use the example of Moby Dick. How many people have got a copy of Moby Dick? It's a book, you guys. Who's got a copy of Moby Dick? Anybody? There's one, two, three copies. Okay, so, but most of you know the title, you know the author, you might know the first line, you know something about the plot, you know that it's thick and maybe that it's boring or that it's a classic. All of that stuff which might be considered metadata inside a normal computational system, it's not really metadata, it's just more information about that object. In fact, you don't even know if you still have a copy because your house may have burned down or someone may have given it away. You might even have two copies without knowing it. And in the real world, we don't have this artificial, very formal distinction between data and metadata. And it doesn't exist in FluidDB either. All information is on the same footing, which means that, you know, you're just as important as I am and just as important as the system user. Okay, so the objects allow for unlimited aggregation of information. There's no a priori organization of the data, which is another interesting sort of departure from normal systems. One of the things that means is that everything is done by search. So if you want to find information or get hold of information in FluidDB, you have to do a search. You can't just walk in the front door and say, oh, here's the top of a hierarchical file system and use that to navigate through the information structure. You have to search. And we'll get to how you search in a minute because there's a query language. Very quickly, one of the things, you know, I said that having objects with no owners changes things and it allows you to do certain things very easily. One of those things is that you can build data structures dynamically. And I think that's very important because it means you can organize information on the fly and no one has to anticipate that you're going to want to do it. And the way that you do it is you just add attributes to objects and you discover the organization by doing a search. So you can have multiple simultaneous organizations of information. They can all exist at the same time. They don't interfere with each other. And that becomes very simple, whereas in a normal world, that's very difficult. If you want to have multiple simultaneous organizations of a bunch of files, it's not so easy. Or if you want to have multiple simultaneous organizations of a bunch of web pages that you find, it's not so easy. It's going to be a lot of manual work, and you're going to put the organizing information somewhere else by necessity, because you don't own the objects that the organizing information is about. Similarly, if you make a mashup, if you think about the way mashups work, you know, if I take you and this telephone, and I make a mashup, and I make some new interesting information, where should I put that information? You know, you can put it on a web page, and then it's gone when the browser goes to another page. But if I want to create new information, where should I put it? The most logical place to put the new information is with the old information. That's the most useful place to stick it. If I want to say, this is a guy who wears black shirts and he comes from Spain, should I put that information into a file somewhere else on my file system? No, I should stick it on him. I should get the object corresponding to him, and I should put an attribute onto him saying, he wears black shirts and he comes from Spain. And if I do that, then other people can search on that information as well. So that's something you can think about. It does, this objects with no owners, it does change things in a way that I think is quite important. Okay, so FluidDB is a database full of these objects. The attributes live in namespaces. So my name is Terry. I might have the Terry namespace. And in there, I could put an attribute called rating. So I have a Terry rating that I'm putting onto objects. There's a very simple query language. I'm going to show it to you in a minute. There's a very simple API, where you can go in and you can say, add an attribute to an object, change an attribute on an object, take an attribute off an object, those sorts of things. It's all HTTP at the moment. There will be an XMPP API. The other thing to say is that users and attributes and namespaces also have objects corresponding to them. So you can build social networks. I can say, you know, this is a friend of mine on Facebook and someone I know on Twitter, and I can do searches where I say, show me people that I know on Twitter that I don't know on LinkedIn, those sorts of things, because there are objects for people and you can't control what I put on your object. So you can build social networks very easily. Also, applications are users, so they have objects as well. Just to be clear, in case it's not obvious to everybody, this is a hosted database. It's a little bit like Amazon SimpleDB. It's sitting out there in the clouds, as they would say if this were a marketing talk. So if you want to use it as an application programmer, you just connect, you make an HTTP request, and it's done. You don't have to install anything. You don't download it. It's not open source at the moment, although it will be in the future, because I like open source. And the reason, of course, that it's hosted like this and that it's centralized, at least in terms of control, is that you want people to put information in the same place. That's the whole point. You want applications and therefore people to be sharing information. But of course, the storage and the query processing and so on is all distributed. So when a query comes in, it gets sent out to various different boxes that resolve parts of the query, and the answers get combined and so on. And I'll describe that quite soon. I guess everyone here is interested in databases and they want to know what's going on inside of this stuff and not the more general.
That's what yeah. I was going to ask about.
I'm getting there. I'm going to keep going quickly and we'll get there. So some of the design goals, this is a hard thing to build. If you go to YouTube, for example, and look at the people making presentations about building key value stores, distributed key value stores, very, very complicated. And they take a lot of time, a lot of smart people, a lot of money, which we don't have, which is not to imply that we have smart people either. But these things are hard to build. So I tried very hard to keep everything simple. The data model is very simple. There's a permissions model, which is very simple. There's a query language, which is very simple. We're trying to make the thing horizontally scalable so we can really make this big. Horizontally scalable, of course, means you can just throw boxes in and scale. And I want to make the common tasks very fast. And finally, most important, it has to be implementable. That's the problem with vision, is that if you've got too much vision, you can't build the thing that you dream up. And it's very easy to have too much vision. I'll just describe the permissions model very quickly. Again, it's supposed to be something you can talk about in 30 seconds. For every action that you might want to take on a namespace or an attribute or an object, there's a policy. And the policy is either open or closed, and there's a list of exceptions. So to give you some examples, here's a, in the first line, there's an attribute called Tim Scene. So you, this is, I did this for Tim O'Reilly. You can imagine that someone is surfing around on the web, and every time they see a web page or they click on a button, they can say, I've seen this page. You're just sort of leaving breadcrumbs to show where you've been. This attribute, if you want to read it, the policy is that it's closed, but there are two exceptions, Tim and someone called Meg. So that Tim might be not willing to share that attribute with people. He doesn't want people to see everything that he looks at on the web. So the permissions model is at the attribute level. On the next line, there's a mic opinion attribute, and if you want to update it, if you want to change it, the policy is open. He's saying anyone can change this attribute if they find it on an object. That's kind of weird, because it's sort of making, he's letting anyone add a mic opinion. In fact, that's actually just a typo in the slide, but I can still explain it. And so on. So the permissions model is very simple. The query language is extraordinarily simple. If you know anything about SQL, and I guess everybody here does, it takes quite a while to describe and also to implement SQL and to support it. It's very heavyweight in many ways. The query language in FluidDB can be described in about 30 seconds as well. You can do queries on attributes where you say, you know, Michael's rating is greater than 4. These are numeric queries. You can do textual matching. So you can say someone's comment contains the word good. You can test for the presence or absence of attributes. So you say, show me everything that has a Tim Seen attribute on it where Terry's rating is greater than 6. And as I just said, you've got Boolean operations. You've got ands and ors and nots and grouping. And that's it. That's all you can do, at least at the moment. And there's a reason for that, which is that I'm trying to build or design something which is incredibly simple and that can actually be implemented by a very small team of people. As I said, there's only two of us. There's advantages from simplicity because you can parallelize these the query processing very easily. The other thing to mention is that the query language is designed to bring back FluidDB objects. All it does is identify FluidDB objects. It's not like SQL where you say, I want to pull out the age and the name and the so-and-so from these different tables, and that's what you get back. In FluidDB, you get back objects. It says, we found some objects that match your query. You can go in and have a look at those objects. I actually have a demo, which is about a year and a half old, but I can show it to you very quickly if you want to have a look. Or I can just keep talking at high speed. I'll start with some simple things. Here's a web page. It's quite long. You can see just by looking at the scroll bar over on the right-hand side that it's a long web page. I'm going to read this web page, but I'm not going to read it now because you would all leave. And what I have up here is a little toolbar. And there's a button here. I don't know if you can read that, but it says, going to read. And I can click on it. And it indicates that I'm planning to read this page. We wrote this toolbar as a very simple example. If you think back to what I said about user interface, you should now be asking yourself the question, what happened to that bit of information that I just added to something? Where did it go? Is there an API? You know, can I get to it? Well, it turns out that that button just put an attribute onto an object inside of FluidDB that corresponds to this web page. Similarly, we have things where you can add ratings to pages, you can add comments, and these are deliberately designed to be extremely simple examples of user interfaces where you can be adding information to the world that you can later get at inside of FluidDB. This is at the extreme end of applications that can be written using FluidDB because they're just managing one attribute. We have a number of others but I'm going to go all the way from this extremely simple applications to the sort of most general, and show you something which I call marbles. And this gets back to what I said before about search being very passive, where you're just reading the results. Why can't you change the results? Marbles is a writable search engine. You can see up here I've done a query that says reddit.com/score is greater than 750. And I've got some results. I don't know if you can see the mouse. I know it's a bit fuzzy because of the video connection. On the left-hand side, we've got some results that look like they might have come out of a search engine. They've got titles and URLs and dates and so on. And on the right-hand side, we have something that looks a little bit like Excel. It's a little bit like a spreadsheet. There's columns with titles, and in the cells, there are values. And I can change the values if I own the attributes. If I have write permission for those attributes, I can change them. So if I want to alter this value, and I apologize that this doesn't look so attractive, I've just changed the result in a search engine, and I can now search on that attribute. I can say, you know, show me things where Terry rating is greater than 5, and that object will come back. Well, in this case, if I said greater than or equal to 5. And I can add new columns. I have this concept of a profile up here where basically you can indicate the kinds of things that you're interested in seeing on the objects that come back. And you can type any query that you like using the FluidDB query language into the search box of marbles. It took about a year to build this demo, by the way. I'm not doing it justice, but it was a lot of work. All of this stuff, of course, is talking to FluidDB, just like the tiny little application that took about an afternoon. Well, actually, that whole toolbar took about a week to write. But something else like this, for example, this was written in a few hours. It's deliberately very bare bones and ugly. The problem we're trying to solve here is that you get different usernames on different systems. And people like to say, you know, I'm Michael on Flickr, and I'm Mike25 on Twitter, and I'm some other username on some other system. Instead of putting that on your blog or sticking it on the side of your web page or whatever, you could be storing that information somewhere more useful. You could put it onto an object that corresponds to that web page. And that has a little bit of utility to you, but it's got more value once you start to combine that information with other people's information. I can do a search and I can say, show me the services where you've got a username where I don't have a username. And all of a sudden I'm seeing things that you're using that I'm not using. And that's kind of the whole point of FluidDB, is information becomes more valuable when you put it in the context of other information that it's related to. It's just like Wikipedia. If you have an incremental fact about the world, the most sensible place to put it, arguably, is, you know, onto the Wikipedia page for that subject. Because when it's in the context of other information, it's more valuable. And that application that I showed you before, where we've got this going to read checkmark here, that's got some value for the individual, but it's much more valuable once you start to combine it with other people's information. You come back after lunch and you say, show me the things I was going to read, you know, that someone else has read and given a rating to of more than 6. Or show me all the things that the people in the office were planning to read. Or show me what the web in general is planning to read. Once you start to combine information like that, you get a lot more value. I'm going to go back to the slides, and if people want to see more demo stuff later, just come and bug me. I mean, come and ask me. So there's a slight slip of the tongue. Anyway, we have a lot of data in there. There's about 20 different data sets. We have stuff we've taken from Flickr. All the NASDAQ stocks are in there. I wrote a little piece of Python to read my iTunes XML file to pull out all the data of the songs that I'd listened to, how many times I'd listened, how many stars I gave them. All that stuff is nice by itself, but it's much nicer when you start combining it with someone else's information. You know, imagine being able to do a search where you say, show me the tracks that my friend has been listening to recently that I don't know about, that I haven't played. There's a venture capitalist in New York called Fred Wilson who publishes every year his list of his 100 top tracks of the year. And he puts it in a pretty useless place, which is in a piece of HTML that he types up and puts online. Imagine if it was just an attribute stuck onto objects inside of FluidDB. You could do queries automatically where you could say, show me the stuff that's in Fred's list this year that wasn't in his list last year. Show me the stuff that I haven't listened to that he's been listening to. What's he heard more than 100 times that I've heard less than 20 times? Those kinds of queries are all possible, and it becomes very easy to do that stuff when you have an architecture that allows people to put attributes onto objects without asking for permission. There's a whole bunch of other stuff in there. There's email stuff in there. We took all the URLs out of Dig, all the URLs out of TechCrunch that had ever appeared. It's like, show me everything that's been mentioned in TechCrunch that hasn't been mentioned in Read-Write Web. Pretty interesting query. But you can't do that on the web today. Why not? Because you don't have an architecture where you can combine all that information. So people can write little tools that go and pull information out of APIs and stick it into FluidDB, and then this sort of stuff becomes trivial. Anyway, we have tons of stuff in there. And there's a lot of queries. You can look at the slides later to see some of these examples. Let me talk a little bit about architecture. We have about 20 minutes left. I'll try and take about 10 and then let you ask some questions. I'll quickly go through some of the software components because not necessarily that you're interested in them, but they're very good and we're relying on them heavily, so I would like to mention them. We're using Twisted, which is a wonderful library of asynchronous networking for Python. It's really great. It's a bit cryptic, but there's a wonderful community. In fact, we're using Python because of Twisted, which is really it's really something. We're also using something called AMQP, which is a messaging system that sits in the middle of the architecture. All the communications goes through AMQP. It's a standard. It was developed by JP Morgan and is, well, with JP Morgan and a company called iMatic. And there's a lot of backers of AMQP now, quite a few from the financial community. There's several open source implementations. There's a reference implementation and so on. There's one that clocks about 600,000 messages going through the messaging hub per second. So you can get fairly quick. It's fairly rapid and so on. And we released a version of AMQP. We open sourced it that's compatible with Twisted. So you've got this asynchronous messaging broker, and we have an asynchronous Python library. So we have completely asynchronous talk from our Python programs through the messaging broker. The next thing is called Thrift, which is something that was open sourced by Facebook, and they use it to define services and structures that get passed around on the network and serialized and unserialized, and there's an RPC mechanism. We released something called TX Thrift, which is a Twisted version of Thrift, so we can have a Python program on one box, basically make a method call through to another box where the structure which is sent over the network is serialized by Thrift. It all goes through the messaging hub called the AMQP messaging hub. It gets routed to the machine where it's supposed to go, unserialized. Everything's asynchronous, and the answer eventually comes back. It's pretty nice, and it's all transparent to the end Python programmer, which in this case is me. So from a communications point of view, I apologize for this 1970s kind of diagram. Everything is going through AMQP. It's not one box in the middle with a central point of failure, but there can be multiple boxes that are doing different kinds of routing for you, and you can add more boxes. And you can load balance, you can arrange for queries to go out through one box and one exchange and come back through another, and so on and so forth. So it's very flexible. In terms of functionality, I'm actually going to get to talk about databases a little bit in a second, so you'll all feel fulfilled and so on. In terms of functionality, you have applications here on the left. They go in through an HTTP server, and they talk to something which we call the facade, which handles all of the permissions and sort of routes traffic through the system. The facade basically sends requests to object servers and namespace servers and attribute servers and text servers. And those things accumulate results and send them to set operation servers, which combine results, and all of the results gradually make their way back to the HTTP front end using Thrift and AMQP, as I mentioned before. This is a, also there's a control mechanism that allows us to go in and talk to a coordinator, which can, you know, tell you things about the system and allow you to bring out more boxes and shut boxes down and so on. It's very easy to add. It's very easy to add boxes here because, in many cases or in all cases, they're hanging off the end of AMQP queues. So if you need more of a certain kind of capacity, you can bring a box up that has that functionality, and it connects to the queue, and then AMQP will give it jobs, give it work to do in a load balancing fashion. It's actually more complicated than this because I take away the arrows. There's things, I've left out AMQP, I've left out the possibility of other APIs, I've left out load balancing, I've left out memcached, which we're not actually doing yet because we haven't had time. I've also left out the key ingredient, which is that these services on the right-hand side, the object service, the namespace service, the attributes, and the textual services, they're all backed by databases. And we're using Postgres, a small round of applause, I think, is in order, to do all of that stuff. So by the time a query is broken down, and I'm going to show you that in a second, and reaches an attribute server, the query is actually very simple. And it can be done into a Postgres table, which is specific to the attribute in question. And I'm going to get to that very soon. And this is all backed by a key value store. Currently, we're using Amazon S3. So periodically, we can dump database tables into keys in Amazon S3 as a form of backup. And the reason we're doing that is because it's reasonably cheap and it's easy to get going, and we are a startup with no money. So if you think about attribute storage, here's an attribute called meg rating. These are basically what I think the database world calls tall tables. They have just a few columns and many rows. We store the object ID. Remember, we have an object that's got an instance of meg rating on it. We store the user ID, the user who created that instance, and we store the value. So if meg puts a rating onto 1,000 things or 100,000 things, all of those things are stored together. That's part of the sort of architectural design of FluidDB, is that we want to scale horizontally and we want the attributes to be stored individually so that we can have hundreds or tens of thousands or millions or sort of any number of attributes just by adding boxes. And the box on which meg rating is stored or being currently held, if that attribute stops being used, it can drop the tables. You know, write the data out to S3, drop the tables, and then if the system ever gets another query in the future involving meg rating, we can bring that attribute out of cold storage, if you like, do a PG restore, get the data back into a table, serve the queries, and keep the attribute hot until such a time as it goes offline again. So the idea is that you have some working set of attributes that are currently being used. You know, there may be hundreds, there may be millions, and you have a much larger set of attributes that haven't been used for a while, and they're basically sitting in cold storage. Let me just show you a little bit about query processing. Here's a fragment of a query. Of course, when this arrives at the front end, it's a string. It gets parsed into a little tree, and at the leaves of the query tree, you always have these little things like, you know, some attribute is greater than 5, or an attribute contains a piece of text, or you're testing for the presence or the absence of an attribute. And the system will take each of those leaves and send the query in the leaf to the attribute service, which is managing that attribute. And that results in a set of object IDs. So all the leaves, when you resolve their little subqueries, they give you a set of basically integers. And as you resolve that query and you go into the OR and you go into the AND and so on, those things are all set operations on integers. And we, as computer scientists, know how to do set operations very quickly. You can do them in parallel. There's very efficient algorithms that basically get you linear speed up with the number of cores that you're using. And so we have some services which can turn out to just be boxes that are only running one particular service, and all they're doing is set operations. And if you get clever about it, you can be streaming object IDs out of queries and into set boxes that are streaming results out without anything having been completed yet. So a box can be in the process of resolving a set operation, and the results are going across the network to another set operations box, which is solving some part of the query higher up in the tree. The other thing that you can do, of course, is you might notice that if this query is very common, Meg's rating is being queried all the time with Tim's scene attribute, perhaps because they're friends or they're both famous or they're actually the same person or whatever, you can move those attributes onto the same box. So the coordinator or something can look at log files, for example, and say, okay, these attributes have been used together very commonly. Let's tell the attribute service here, the one in the middle, to drop that attribute, basically flush it back to S3 if it's necessary, and we'll tell the attribute service at the bottom to pick up that attribute. So all of a sudden, you've got these two attributes sitting on the same machine, and that means that when the query goes to get resolved, you can send a subtree of the query to the one box, and it can do the processing locally. Yes?
Isn't there an issue with doing that and still concurrently serving?
Yes. Yeah.
How do you?
Well, we don't yet, but I think it is an issue. In fact, I have a feeling that this arrangement is better when you get to scale, and that it's better to always say, we're just going to send this off somewhere else to do the work, because you don't want, for example, to make hotspots. And you don't necessarily, it can be quicker to do the processing locally, like to process two things at the same time on the same box. But if you've got massive amounts of data, it might be quicker just to send it somewhere else every single time. That's something which we haven't even looked at yet. But
when it comes to doing the actual move, I would recommend looking at something like long dist or some other form of replication, because that would allow you to move something basically in real time. Because you can do the bulk of the move, and you only then have to acquire a lock for a small time to actually finalize the move and say, okay, now it's canonically over here.
Uh-huh. I don't even know what that is.
It basically, if you have to like dump everything out while you're in the process.
Yeah. No, I mean lone disk. I don't know what lone disk is.
It's a replication scheme. Yeah. There's a couple different ones for Postgres. It's the one I'm most familiar with.
Yeah.
But the idea is to allow for changes to still be coming in as you're copying the data over, and then you can just cut over.
Yeah, I agree. And that's the, you know, having a flag set or whatever, which says that this is we're in the process of moving this attribute somewhere else, and then when it finally comes up, you say, okay, let's ship the differences that have come in since we started the move. I guess that's exactly what you're talking about, and then
be live in both places.
Okay, well that's good too. Yeah, we also expect to transition to the point where we're using AMQP more to broadcast writes, for example. And then sort of, that's a more optimistic strategy where you fix errors afterwards. And that also leads to a discussion about what kinds of applications are we building this for? Because if you know anything about databases, and I know that you do, you know, there's a lot of issues that I've sort of papered over, and we're not trying to address huge databases, we're not trying to address financial data and so on. We're thinking much more about little apps that people are writing on iPhones and so on. Or the kinds of things that I showed you, like Firefox extensions, at least in the first place. And then this is actually the last slide. Each box in the network has got a controller service, and when you say to the server, when the coordinator says to the server farm, hey, I need a new box for the following kind of purpose, like a message broker or an attribute service, it comes up, the controller runs, and then you talk to it through AMQP or straight through Thrift, and you tell it what to do, and you give it services to run and so on. And we're building that part of the system on top of Amazon EC2 right now, although that may change if we get some favors from Sun. I have a smile over in the corner. So we're using EC2 and we're using S3, and those two services really are quite extraordinary. I think they're changing the world as well. They're making it possible for a little tiny startup company to try building something, you know, which really does have a lot of scale, and doing it fairly cheaply and fairly easily. Okay, well, that's it for today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Have you posted anything about your experience bringing up Postgres on EC2, S3 for that matter?
No, I haven't. We haven't had any trouble. There's some quite active mailing lists where people are... We're using Ubuntu, but we're not doing anything strange.
I just didn't know how much info was out there, because I know that there's like canned images for MySQL and stuff like that.
Yeah. We're not using any of those things. In fact, there's a brand new Ubuntu set of EC2 images. We've been building our own using some tools written by a guy called Eric Hammond. And, you know, all we do is we apt-get install all the packages that we need, including Postgres, and it just works absolutely fine. But we haven't written anything down yet. There's a lot of things I haven't written down. Yes?
So I have a question about ownership of the data.
Yes.
Is this data owned by your company? Because I'm thinking about, like, in the real world, what makes me me is my DNA. Okay? On the web, I'm thinking, okay, the places I go and the things I do, that kind of makes me me also.
Yes, yeah.
So if all of a sudden what makes me me winds up in...
In me, data, yeah. Right. Yeah. No, we don't... Yeah. We don't own any of the data. We don't want to own any of the data. And in fact, the nice thing about FluidDB is that a user can continue to own and control their own information, which is another change, it's quite a departure from normal systems. And one of the departures is that as an application writer, you know, as a programmer, you have some choices that you can make that you've never had to make before, which is you can let the user own their own information. So you can imagine if you were writing a photo uploader, like imagine you're writing a Flickr, and you let the user upload the images. There's some attributes there. You know, maybe the date at which the thing got uploaded is an attribute. Maybe you should own that. But the bits of the photo, well, you know, arguably they should be owned by the user. And if you do that as a programmer, you've got to think about the consequences, because it means that in the future when you run again, when your application runs and you go to find your objects by doing a search, you may find some objects that don't even have the bits anymore of a photo on them, because the user exercised their freedom to go and use some other application and to remove those, to remove the object or to change the image. And in FluidDB, you really do continue to own your own information. And there's a programming... I think that's a difficult thing in terms of adoption, to get programmers to think like that. Yeah.
And so if they could go to FluidDB, I mean, they could learn all about me, and maybe I don't want them to know.
Yeah, well, but I'm trying to build an information architecture that's a bit more like the real world, and you face the same problem in the real world. You know, they can go and ask your neighbors if you have any bad habits, and so on and so forth. That's just the way the world works.
True, but it's easier to hide out there.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
So how do you, as a person, how do you manage that situation?
I don't know is the best answer, but I can give some suggestions. For example, you might put more information onto an object saying this, you know, the following is not true and so on. Because we have namespaces, all the users have a namespace, you can go to the object that corresponds to that person and you can say, this person is a liar, or don't believe what this person says. The only answer is to add more information to the world. You can't You can't force someone to take information off. You could take them to court in the real world and say, hey, this is libel, or this person is slandering me, or something like that. But the architecture of FluidDB doesn't give you any support for doing stuff like that. And I think another way to answer this question, which I also think is very important, is that it's an evolutionary system, and selection pressure and convention and the evolution of reputation and trust and so on will be very important, and those things will evolve. Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, like, I think it's nice anyway.
Yeah.
So, I mean, have you given any thought to that? Like, maybe that FluidDB should eventually forget?
No, I haven't. There's a sort of opposite question, or a related question, which is, does FluidDB have a time dimension? You know, if you look at something like Google Bigtable, there's a time dimension. And when I get asked questions like the one that you just asked, my answer is always, on the one hand, I try to keep things as simple as they possibly can be and not to add anything else. And on the other hand, if you do want more things, then you can layer them on top by writing a library, which gives you, for example, objects that have a history or objects that lose track of attributes. And then you, instead of talking to the raw API, you talk to the library, which manages FluidDB objects in that particular way for you. But at the lowest level of the architecture, there's nothing like that. The problem is, apart from the fact that it's to my taste to make things very simple, we've got so few resources, and this problem is already so difficult to try and build that we can't do anything apart from the absolute basics. It's like, think of the simplest thing that could possibly work and say no to everything else, and just try and build that to start with.
That's an interesting idea, though, to say that that's an application-level decision.
Well, it's a library. I think of it as a library.
Okay.
that applications would use. If you think about graphics programming, let's say 25 years ago or so, you had to do everything very manually. You had to paint all the pixels yourself, and you had to look up the width of the characters, and if you wanted someone to, you know, be able to backspace across a line break or something, you had to, you know, find the background color, paint the rectangle in. And eventually we got libraries, you know, we got widget libraries and so on that made some of that stuff very easy, like very simple. I think there will be libraries that can be written on top of FluidDB to manage stuff for you. Like, if you want a hierarchical tree, hierarchical trees are very useful for things. If you want one, you can build it out of attributes. But you can ask a manager to do it. You say, hey, I want a hierarchical tree. Put this in this folder, and the attribute manager will do it for you. And I've written some of those things to build data structures for you, but they're not built into the lowest level. There's actually very few data structures that we use. You know, there's lists, there's folders, there's trees, and there's not much else. And you can just build them dynamically with a manager of some kind. Yes?
So it seems that this is definitely the type of application that will benefit from network effect. In other words, the more people using it, the more useful it is.
Yes.
What kind of things are you going to do to try and entice people to write applications against this and you know, basically get that network effect started so that it actually...
Yeah, there's a few things. I'm going to go to conferences and talk to gullible developers who are looking for the next interesting thing to come across the radar screen and go out and hack on it. There are many thousands of people who are looking for new APIs and playing with things and building little tools. So that's one answer. You know, go to the community and say, you know, I'm a programmer. You guys are programmers. We all have the same kinds of problems. Here's some cool stuff that you can do. Number two, there's a lot of data that we can just put into the system ourselves. Like, for example, all the URLs that have been in Dig or the Reddit, the things that have been in Reddit with their date and their score. It's trivial to get that stuff into FluidDB. It's a trickle of data compared to, you know, real applications. And you can write something like that in about half an hour because you go to the API for Dig or for Reddit or whatever, you pull out the data and you stick it into FluidDB and you're done. You need to use cron or something like that to periodically wake up and do it again. That gets you a lot of nice data. In fact, there's a lot of companies that want you to have their data. Like if you look at Amazon, for example, there's a whole API where they're saying, please take information about our products and build apps with it. So we can take the Amazon price out of their API and stick it onto FluidDB objects that are about books. And people can do searches that they've never been able to do before. And the third part of the answer is that we're going to build some of those little things ourselves and open source them and give them away, like this Firefox toolbar. And hopefully, you know, as you say, the network effect is really there, which I bet my house on, literally. And once you start to get some of those things out there and people are doing interesting, unanticipated things, you'll get more and more of them. Like, here's an example I really like to use, which is very idiosyncratic, is Esteve, who's the guy I work with, is colorblind. And he wants a single button on Firefox so he can click on a page if he can't read it properly. He just wants to indicate that this page is not good for colorblind people. That's a piece of input. You can write that. He could write it in probably 15 minutes. I could write it in a week or two. You can release that as a Firefox extension. And then on the other hand, you can release, let's say, a GreaseMonkey script so that when one of those pages comes back to you as a result of a search or whatever, the fact that it's bad for colorblind people is detected by a single query to FluidDB, and then you do something, like you change the color map. Those kinds of applications are extremely easy to write. They're very idiosyncratic. They're particular to communities of people who care about each other. The colorblind community would pass an app like that around fairly quickly, I think. And that stuff can be combined. You know, maybe not so much in the case of colorblindness, although there's various different kinds of colorblindness. But if you think about, for example, geo data, you know, people wandering around with iPhones saying, here's my latitude and my longitude, you know, get me a Woo ID from Yahoo, and then I want to say, I've been here, there's a restaurant I liked here, you know, put a rating onto something or other. That kind of data is all related. It's all tied together by place. And that's where you're going to find network effects, that I think, in the strongest way.
Have you talked to, like, Twitter, for example? Because it seems to me that you could actually basically implement Twitter on top of this.
Yeah, that's. I do know some people at Twitter. I spent quite a lot of time talking to Jack Dorsey quite recently. I can't say exactly what we talked about, but they also think about attributes and values and so on tweets. And if you look at the Twitter mailing list and various other places online, there's people asking, you know, why can't we put stuff into the Twitter database? Why can't we add, you know, a rating on a user or a comment or even have a currency? You know, Dave Weiner is very thoughtful about Twitter. He posts a lot of stuff about Twitter, and he says, why can't we just have an artificial currency where I can say, this tweet is worth 50 cents, 50 Dave cents, and build up a little economy? That's what happens when you have a successful application. People start saying, we want to get access to the data. And that's all in a traditional database, and you can't open up the traditional database, so you write a third-party API, like the Twitter API, and then you wind up with hundreds of applications going through this sort of crippled API. There's only one application going through the full API, and the interesting applications generate new data, and they put it in their own database with their own API and their own documentation, their own servers and their own programmers, and it's a mess. Instead of being able to do the natural thing, which is take the little tiny bit of information that you just generated and put it into the database where it's most useful. So yeah, you could build a Twitter system inside of FluidDB. And I actually think of FluidDB as a more of a communications platform than anything else. So for example, if you make an object inside of FluidDB and you put some attributes onto it and then you delete them, the object doesn't go away. It stays in existence for all time. And that's pretty useful because you can use it as a place for applications to communicate. You can drop stuff up in there and another application can take information out of there, like a producer and consumer system. And it's a communications platform for applications in some sense. And therefore also for users, because users drive applications. So there's lots of different ways of looking at what we're doing, and this is just some of them. I tried to put a bit of a database spin on it for you.
So you've got a real object model, and I'm wondering how, if you're bumping into the limitations of a relational database to represent those objects.
No, not at all. I mean, we're using the relational database in such a simple way that we can get away with not knowing very much about databases. because we have these tall tables with an index. In fact, I implemented the first time using Berkeley B-trees, and I implemented it using a Zope DB, and I actually implemented it using MySQL about 11 years ago, and now we're using Postgres, but in a very simplistic manner. And I don't think we're going to hit the limits.
Are you familiar with MetaWeb and all?
Yeah.
Because they have that Freebase product.
Yes, yeah.
It's really built on the MetaWeb tools, which is kind of similar in a way. How do you differ from what they do?
Well, there's a few ways that we're quite different. They seem to believe in ontology, or they have an emphasis on ontology to some extent. I don't know the exact details, but you know, they would like to have a group of experts, let's say about wine, who would say, you know, these are the characteristics of a bottle of wine that are important, and these are the slots that are going to be involved in a wine object. Whereas we don't have any of that sort of stuff at all. Another thing about Freebase is that everything's readable, so there isn't a permissions model in there. Everything is readable. You can't build an app where you have a private opinion about something, or something that you, like a latitude and a longitude that you share with your family, and a latitude and longitude that you share with your friends, and that you have a protection on them. You can't do that sort of thing. Also, the query language is extremely complicated from my point of view. I read the API when it first came out. I read the manual. It was 150 pages. And the queries are designed to be built by programs, which is fine, and it's very powerful. You can do a lot of stuff. And in FluidDB, the queries are designed to be written by humans. You know, I want to launch Marbles as a search engine so that normal people, I mean, and when I say that, I mean people like us, can go in there and type a query, like say, Terry's rating is greater than 5. Most people can't type a query like that, but there's a hell of a lot of geeks, if you don't mind me using that word, who can handle typing in a very simple query language like that. In Freebase, I don't think that there's... First of all, I don't think there's an interface like that, because you're typing in JSON and it's quite verbose. And so that aim is very different. Also, they're going after big data. They're really interested in big data. They want people to import large data sets and to be very fast and so on. And I would say I'm going after little data, idiosyncratic, weird, funny data that people want to build in little apps and combine and share. And we don't have the resources. You know, we don't have $57 million of funding or whatever they have to go after very much more at the moment. Yeah. In fact, I had 29 euros in the bank about 2 weeks ago. So if that gives you any idea of scale.
Well, I guess I know what the founders are today, but they've struggled for quite some time to get on the formula. Because I think they know a lot about technology, but what I think you have them is, I think you know more about the market.
Well, I know more about me. So, you know, I really fundamentally believe that everybody is full of idiosyncratic, rich, valuable information. It's valuable to themselves and to their friends and so on. And we just don't have anywhere useful to put it computationally, that where we can make use of it and share it with each other and protect it and so on and so forth. And I'm trying to build something that allows me to do that. I want to sit inside of Emacs and do my own wacky little meta X commands that do funny little things with, you know, the last URLs that I visited and all these little idiosyncratic itches that I want to scratch. I'm trying to build an architecture that lets me do all of them. And I think there are people like me out there who will like to do the same thing. And I know there are people out there who, you know, they're colorblind and they want to use a little app for colorblind people that can be written in an afternoon.
The semantic web seems to be coming at it from the backward side of the problem of, hey, yeah, so we've got all these text pages, which is ultimately what it all is. And, like, there's so much information here, but we can't figure out what the hell it is. So maybe we try and define something to do that, whereas the more logical approach is, how about if we have a standardized global distributed database that you can just put stuff in? And then if you want to build, you know, when you build your nice, pretty web page implementation, it's just, oh, yeah, go pull this information out of here.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because I didn't have to say it. But in there's various things that I don't like as a computer scientist. I don't like semantics. I don't like natural language understanding stuff very much. I don't like artificial intelligence. I think those are all things that you shouldn't work on, to put it frankly, because they're too difficult. On the other hand, if you are going to work on something like semantics or natural language understanding and so on, it makes more sense to me that you do it on top of a flexible architecture so that when you figure out that an object is about, you know, Jaguar the cat rather than Jaguar the car, something that you never, I mean, by definition, you're trying to figure out things that you don't know. You know, you're doing this semantic analysis, you're trying to figure stuff out, and you don't know what you're going to figure out or what other people are going to figure out. And so by definition, you sort of need an architecture that allows you to be infinitely flexible.
And that you can figure it out and then say, by the way, this thing is really pointing about this over here,
yeah.
And then nobody has to do it again.
Yeah, and to do whatever you want. Whatever it is that you want to do in the future, you should be able to do it. And you shouldn't be restricted by architectural decisions that were made by a programmer who thought they knew what they were doing a year ago or 10 years ago. And so the only comment I would really make about this stuff is, if you want to do that kind of stuff, use a more flexible architecture to base it on top of. I personally don't want to I don't want to go in that direction, but you know, that's just my taste.
But that's probably the most important point. I mean, I see a lot of value in this tool, whereas, as you mentioned, to make the web writable, so you can just add your bit or pieces of information to any website you best. But I see even more value in the ability to do data mining. I mean, not yeah. from a business intelligence perspective, that's business, but from your own perspective, I want to mine this data because I want to correlate with some other data. And right now you can't unless you do a lot of programming on your own.
Yeah.
So I see a lot of value in this kind of tools because information is going to be related some way and you can correlate it to get the information you want to get out of it.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of value there too, and those things can all be written on top of FluidDB as applications. We don't have time to write them. I would love to have people write them or to do them myself at some point. I can't wait to reach the point where this is stable enough that we can launch it, hopefully at the end of June, and then we can actually start writing some of these things ourselves.
I would still pay attention for the stuff that was mentioned about, you know, if someone talks something bad. You said that, you know, natural evolution, I mean, if this tries to mimic the world, it can work out that, you know, people will vote it negatively. But if they vote it negatively, sometimes I think it would be useful to just forget about it, what they also talk.
Yeah.
That would be a very useful feature because in the data era, everything stays forever. Sometimes it doesn't really make sense that some stuff stays. So I would give that a thought.
Yeah, it's also...
flexibility.
No, it's still flexible. But when something is really negatively voted, it's worthless. So why keep it? I mean,
it
depends
on what it is.
It depends, and that also gets towards the question of spam. What is spam? You can't really say if something's valuable to me, but not to you, is it spam? If someone sends me an unsolicited commercial email, and it's a product that I like and I want to buy, you know, it had some value.
You're the one that keeps buying that.
That's why I'm responsible for all the spam.
That really brings a point. I mean.
Who decides what the value of something is?
Yeah, who decides? I don't want to decide. That's part of the point is I don't want...
Yeah, but if you're not deciding clubs, I mean, you know, spam is a really good point. If because of people saying, well, you know, this is worthless for me, but, you know, sorry, it's worthless for others, but to me, it's really worth it. Yeah, but you're using...
If you were to start forgetting stuff out of this, I would think the way to do that would be you just start aging it into colder and colder storage, and eventually it's just, nobody gives a shit anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I do think you can have the evolution of reputation and trust. And, you know, if you're the kind of guy who's a spammer or who makes random comments in talks that I don't like, then I can sort of ignore you. Or if you're my friend, but I don't like your taste in movies, then I just sort of stop paying attention to that particular attribute of yours. And if I do like your taste in books, that's an attribute I can use. And I can say, so-and-so's got a very good taste in books, and that attribute has a fitness.
At the end of the day, my opinion, okay, perhaps I'm very idiosyncratic and I don't really like all of this social network stuff you know, there's a lot of tweeting that goes around that it's completely worthless. So if you follow that scheme, at the end of the day, you really have to filter every single thing you don't want. And there's massive amount of...
Well, I don't think that's... I think you can flip that argument around. You can say, you just have to filter the stuff that you do want.
Okay, so you block everything by default, and then you keep...
Yeah, and you say, I'm interested.
So then you lose the network effect, because you don't know...
Not necessarily.